You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The number of new COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin has been falling over the past several days. The state has also been removed from Chicago's quarantine list. Coming up, we'll look at the positive developments here in the state and what the fall could look like. First, public health experts say there's a big factor that's holding us back from getting the upper hand on COVID-19. It's not just the lack of a vaccine or people not wearing masks or not social distancing, though all of those are important. It's a lack of standardized data. Sure, we hear about the number of positive and negative tests, hospitalizations, and deaths coming out of local and state offices. Those figures only say so much. And health officials say it's particularly critical to get that standardized data as we creep closer and closer to the start of a new school year. Dr. Amish Adalja is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. He focuses on emerging infectious disease, pandemic preparedness, and biosecurity. Dr. Adalja, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We see lots of data, lots of numbers when it comes to COVID-19, but how is it falling short when it comes to standardizing, to know we're comparing apples to apples from one community to another?
It's very hard to do that because states have their own data collection systems. They look, some of them may be including certain types of tests and not including other types of tests. Some might be lumping certain tests together. And then you also have the idea of these lags that some states will all of a sudden update their numbers when they get a bunch of lab reports from a private lab, for example. And then that can make things look like something has gotten out of control or something is better than it is, because it's reflecting some time in the past. And I think it makes it very hard for someone who doesn't spend time poring over that data and looking at all the fine print to be able to get an accurate perception of what's going on in their given region or community.
It seems like a basic thing in some ways. Why can't we get every state on the same, or at least the same-ish page when it comes to how we collect and tabulate data like this?
We're in the midst of a pandemic, and you have to remember that state health departments, county health departments, city health departments, their computer systems and their data collection are not what we're used to in our day-to-day life. These departments are often neglected, and they don't necessarily have modern equipment, and it is going to cause problems with data. Eventually, we will get a picture when all of that data is collated by groups like the CDC, but in the midst of this, it's something that we expected to see, and it's something that happens during every pandemic. In the fog of that pandemic, a lot of that data is kind of moving parts and really comes with a lot of caveats.
How does this lack of standardized data get in the way of our efforts to contain COVID-19?
Well, you want people to know what's going on in their community so that they can take actions based on it. So if they know what the percent positivity of tests are, if they know how many cases are arising that are not on the radar of contact tracers, they want to know what's going on in their hospitals in real time, not just how many people have been hospitalized over the last month, but how many are in the hospital now and what percentage of hospital capacity is being used for COVID patients. All of that really helps a person decide how safe it is for them to do certain activities. And it's also really important for people who are trying to respond to that they have access to that data as well, because we are allocating resources and making decisions based on those numbers. So the more accurate, the more real time, the more transparent they are, the better you can actually use them to facilitate us moving through this pandemic.
I guess another question is, how do we know if interventions are working? Say a new mask mandate comes along, or shutdown orders or reopen orders. If our data is, this happened today, plus or minus 2 weeks, does that muddy the waters to figure out the impact of these changes?
It definitely does, because what you see is that people don't contextualize the information that well, and they don't realize that something all of a sudden is going up, and that's because there was a data dump from maybe a VA hospital finally reported their data, and now that's in the state numbers, and it makes things look bad. But then when you look in the little parentheses, it's like, oh, those positive tests go back a month and a half. So it makes it impossible to really do things if you don't know what the data is actually reflecting.
We're talking to Dr. Amish Adalja from the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. He says, there's a lot of data out there when it comes to COVID-19, but data is collected differently in different hospitals, local units, states, and it's really hard to figure out sometimes what's going on, especially in real time. Dr. Adalja, it sounds like the best fix would be a time machine and go back 2 years and get things ready for the pandemic. We can't do that, obviously. Are there fixes that would at least get us there, even amidst, as you said, the fog of this pandemic?
So what I think has happened is so many people have gotten interested in epidemiology. There's many websites that do try to standardize that. One is the institution that I'm affiliated with, Johns Hopkins, where there is a dashboard where you can look at a lot of state level data. There's the COVID tracking project as well. So there are other people that are kind of picking up and standardizing that data and making it more usable. So it's not always that you have to rely only on your state's dashboard, because there are people out there trying to contextualize it and understand it. And I think it's hard for the public, because they want to go to a government, they may want to go to a government source, but what we've seen is the private sector in this pandemic really get very interested in epidemiology and provide really good information. So, you know, I myself infrequently look at state dashboards, but look at some of the other organizations that are collecting data to actually know that it's all standardized and see the caveats really laid out.
For a layperson listening and thinking, I want to know what's going on in my town, city, county, that, you know, really local level, what would you recommend to them to try to get the most up-to-date data?
So what I would look at is probably the county health department that you're in, and trying to see how many tests that are being sent are coming back positive. I think that's the easiest one. It tells you how hard or easy it is to find cases in your given area. And if your percent positivity is going down, it's below 5% or so, you really are in a much better shape than if it's 10%. And watching that trend. And then also just pay attention, read the fine print and say, the test results from today reflect tests that were conducted from blank and blank, and try just keep that in mind. It's usually written there, but people overlook that part of it, including the press. And that will give you an idea of how real time the data is.
On the other hand, I know it's easy to get caught up in today's numbers from the state or whatever, and there can be little wiggles up and down. That daily number might not be representative. How do we average things out, I guess, to get a good sense, whether we're individuals or policymakers, to get a good sense of the direction, the trends of cases and deaths and hospitalizations?
So what people do is usually take 7 days and average them together to try and remove some of the day-to-day changes that might occur, because maybe a nursing home got tested on this day, or maybe a jail got tested on this day that caused some difference, or there was a data dump on one of those days. So all of that is sort of minimized when you look at 7 or 14 or 10-day averages, rolling averages. And a lot of that data is available publicly if you look for it. So it does give you a broader sense of the general trend and the trajectory in a given region versus a snapshot just that minute, which could be subject to something that acutely happened that day.
It looks like we're going to be dealing with COVID-19 one way or another for a long time now, but I'm going to get ahead of myself a little bit. Can we learn lessons from where we are now, so when we're past this, we get systems in place for, God forbid, the next pandemic, so we're not trying to scramble to make sense of these, you know, non-standardized numbers in the future?
I do think that this pandemic is really a wake-up call to most people, because all of us in the field have been warning about pandemics, but even when you look back at 2009 H1N1, it was a mild pandemic, and it didn't really shake people to their core the way that this one did. And now we can see how much having a better system to prepare for pandemics would have saved us in terms of the trillions of dollars of loss, the disruption, the hundreds of thousands of lives lost. All of that didn't have to be this way. So I do think that now there is this window of opportunity to get this right, to fortify our pandemic preparedness, because it's not a question of if there's going to be another pandemic. It's inevitable there will be another pandemic. And we cannot afford to have these mistakes be made again and again and again.
Dr. Adalja, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That is Dr. Amesh Adalja, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. We talked to them today about how a lack of consistent public health data on COVID-19 across the country is making the fight against the pandemic more difficult than it needed to be. Coming up, we'll see what the latest data says about how Wisconsin is doing in its battle against the coronavirus. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics, including nationwide Democrats' reactions to the DNC so far and congressional response to the Postmaster General's statement yesterday on controversial changes at the Postal Service. First, we've got the newest figures on COVID-19 cases here in Wisconsin. The Department of Health Services says there were 663 new cases, but only about 9,400 tests. That's the fourth straight day with fewer than 10,000 of those tests. The percentage of positive cases ticked up to 7%. 8 people died. Lately, the news has been getting a little better for Wisconsin on the COVID front. after topping 1,000 positive cases on three separate days earlier this month. The average for the past 7 days is 720. In late July, that was 930. That's when Chicago added Wisconsin to its quarantine list, meaning you had to isolate yourself for 2 weeks before you could go visit the Bean. Yesterday, Chicago removed Wisconsin from that list. Dr. Patrick Remington is professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, good to have you back with us.
Good to be back, Rob.
Dr. Remington, I look at these numbers all the time as part of my job. As a person, I'm grasping at straws to find good news. It seems like this decline in cases in Wisconsin, I can read that as good news. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. I think if you step back from the data, you know, day to day, and just look at the trend, and anybody can do that if you just Google DHS for Department of Health Services and COVID, you'll get to their website. It's a great website. You know, it's updated daily, but you can just stand back and look at the graphic for what has happened in trends in the number of cases reported, the incidence of COVID-19. And you'll see that there was a increase until the end of May, and then there was a really great turnaround, but then it went started going back up, and it peaked at the end of July, as you mentioned in the intro, at about 1,000 cases. And since the end of July, in the last 2 to 3 weeks, we've been seeing a slow but progressive decline, and that's good news. That means that people are doing what they need to do, more so than they were doing at the end of May and at the end of July when we saw increasing cases.
Yeah, talk a little more about that. I know it can be hard sometimes to attribute cause and effect, as we were just hearing. It can be hard to sort out the data in a way that, tells the story. What do you think would be causing this downward trend in positive tests in Wisconsin?
Well, again, I agree with your previous guest that good data are essential. And I think as long as we have these long-term trends, we can rely on them to say that we see a general decrease in the incidence. And we can't pinpoint that. We don't know if people are just spending more time outside. August has been a pretty nice month as far as weather. That could be a factor. It could be that people have started wearing masks more as information has become available that it's not only a good way to protect others, but there's increasing evidence that it's a good way to protect yourself. And there are rules now at businesses and in some communities where masks are required. So I think all of these things, physical distancing, staying outside and wearing the mask if you're going to be inside or closer to people than you should be, all of those things could be coming together and causing this big trend. But again, just around the corner, we have school starting, we have university starting. So we have to pay attention to not just doing a good job over the first few weeks of August, but really continuing this into the fall.
Yeah. And on the also on the downside of things, I'm watching the national numbers. We're seeing an average of a little over 1,000 deaths a day nationwide, not the concentrated disaster we saw back in April in the New York City area. But not good. What do you make of the national numbers you're seeing?
Well, the national numbers, as in Wisconsin, show that there's not one place in this country, not one place in the world that is going to escape COVID-19. The interesting thing within Wisconsin, it's almost a microcosm of the nation in that we began with outbreaks in our urban centers in Milwaukee, in Brown County, from an occupational outbreak at a meatpacking plant. And then it began to spread to suburban and more populous communities. But now, if you look at the top 10 counties in the last 7 days, 9 of them are rural counties when you look at the rate per capita. And that's really important. You can't just count cases because bigger places are going to have more cases. They have more people. You want to look at the per capita or the rates. And when you do that, some counties like Sawyer County or Marinette County, they have the highest risk of spreading COVID of any place in the state. And that's just like we're seeing in the nation as rates begin going up in some rural states and are going down in some Northeast urban centers.
One more factor we've got to watch is the number of tests we're doing in Wisconsin. I know there's some concern that we've dipped down under that 10,000 a day mark. Are we doing enough testing? If not, why not?
Well, testing is pretty complicated in that it takes an interaction with either a testing center or a healthcare provider. People may have gotten tested and gotten a negative result and feel that that's good for now. Well, if you have symptoms and if you have exposures, you need to retest. We are seeing more tests available, but people are really looking to have that test become more rapid, so that that information, you really want to act on that information. If somebody's positive, you want to isolate them immediately and contact their anybody who's been near them and have them go into quarantine. And by waiting a couple of days or 3 or 4 days, that effectiveness of that contact tracing becomes much less. So we really want not just more tests, but we want tests with a quicker turnaround so that we can act on it and people can do what they need to do to isolate themselves if they're sick and they're infected, and also then quarantine anybody who's been in close contact with them.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest COVID-19 data here in Wisconsin. Some good news, with a lot of question marks still out there, but at least the number of positive tests has been going down recently here in Wisconsin. Dr. Remington, it is, as you mentioned, back to school season. We've already seen around the country some colleges open and then go to virtual right away after outbreaks. What can we do to make sure, as we try to reopen institutions, whether it's a campus, a school, a business, whatever, that we aren't opening 1 week and having to close a week later because we're spreading this thing?
Well, first, it would be great if we had some precedent to look at how to do this. But this is the first time this virus has circulated in our country, the first time we've attempted to open schools and universities. So we're learning. We're learning from other universities around the country. And I think there are ways to have instruction that is in person, but through the use of masks and having low density or people spread out. We know that that works in healthcare settings and in other indoor places, so it can work in an educational setting. But when people come back to school, they may go outside, they may gather on a playground if they're kids, or they may gather socially on campus. And we hope that they heed the advice of public health experts and of the leadership at universities. But this is going to be a trial, and other universities have seen early evidence of outbreaks and decided to pull the plug early. We'll know very quickly. Students are returning to UW-Madison next week, and so we'll test every student as they arrive in the dormitories and be able to then monitor them very closely over time. So I think a combination of good education, good instructions to students about what it means to be safe, and then good testing and intervening with isolation and contact tracing for people who need to be quarantined. And that's the kind of the bread and butter of how you control an epidemic. And I think it can work if everybody plays their part and everybody helps. But it doesn't take too many people not to really follow good practices to spoil it. And time will tell what will happen in Wisconsin.
I know there's a lot of attention to treatment. There have been some positive developments at the hospital level, sometimes really simple interventions like turning a person over. How are we doing on treatment for people who catch this and are feeling the worst effects?
Well, we have to be very careful to make sure that sort of the treatment of the day that gets announced is not assumed to be effective. It takes a while to learn about effective treatment. It takes carefully designed, randomized, controlled trials where you compare one intervention to the other. A lot of information that we get comes from what we call observational studies, where you simply observe people who've had one treatment versus the other. And those can be tremendously biased. Some people might take an antacid or another medication, and they're different than people who don't. And so just because you see better outcomes in people who are observed to be doing a certain thing or taking a certain medicine doesn't mean that's going to be effective when it's actually studied. So I recommend people sort of not read the the headlines and the news about a promising treatment, I recommend they talk with their healthcare provider about treatments that have been shown to be effective. And those are relatively few. There are some promising treatments that have gone into clinical trials, but right now there's been marginal improvement in the treatment effectiveness.
We're having these kind of daily arguments. Should we open school? Shouldn't we? Should Big Ten play football? Shouldn't they? Things like that. But those are kind of symptoms, right? Is the underlying story our success or failure at controlling this thing overall?
Well, the underlying story is the virus. This virus is wicked in that it has an ability to spread before people get symptomatic. It has an ability to spread through the air, maybe even further than 6 feet. Sometimes people, the good news is sometimes people are asymptomatic, but that's also a problem in that asymptomatic people might go out and not wear a mask and connect with other people. So I think the story is that this virus has characteristics that make it incredibly hard to control. And so it makes things like opening up schools and universities extremely complex. There are many things that have to work together to be successful. And as we've seen with other campuses, Michigan State and Notre Dame, not everything was working as they thought it might. And so the alternative, a distance-based education, I think at the university level works quite well. I think many people are going to be teaching in the fall at UW. Using distance technology. And so that's not a terrible thing if we have to resort to distance-based technologies. And certainly it's safe. People are not coming together in large gatherings using distance-based teaching.
Dr. Remington, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked to him today about the recent COVID-19 trends here in the state. Coming up after the news, Russian meddling in the 2016 election is back in the news again. We'll look at a new bipartisan Senate report that provides more details about connections with Trump's campaign and transitional team. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Democrats are halfway through their national convention, and Joe Biden is now officially the party's nominee for president. We'll check up on the convention and how Democrats are working to project party unity during the four-day, mostly virtual event. First, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. We'll get the latest on what the Postmaster General says he is and isn't going to do about controversial changes at the Postal Service, as well as a final Senate Intelligence Committee report on its own investigation into Russian interference into the 2016 election. And last night brought us, as we said, to the half point in the Democratic National Convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching the first couple of nights? What thoughts do you have, whether you are a Democrat, Republican, or other? Are you planning to watch tonight and tomorrow? What are you looking forward to seeing or hearing? What do you think they've done well so far? What else would you like to see or hear from this convention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Fisher is a senior editor at The Washington Post. He's also co-author of the biography Trump Revealed, An American Journey of Ambition, Ego, Money, and Power. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, you reported on reactions from some Democrats around the country to what they're seeing from this convention. What kind of things are you hearing from people?
Well, I'm hearing a real passion for unity. People want to defeat Donald Trump. Democrats do, at least. And they are coming together around that common goal. But behind that surface unity is a real divide over what the Democratic message ought to be. Should it be just we're the anti-Trumpers, or should it be a very detailed program of reform on all the issues that we've been talking about this year? There's a divide about that, about that kind of tactical question. And then there's the deeper divide, the ideological divide between the sort of left-wing Democrats and the more moderate folks. Many of the Democrats I've been talking to around the country really have not gotten from this convention a clear sense that even the party knows which of those messages it wants to put out this year. Obviously, they're trying for a sense of big tent coalition building, that kind of, yes, we all need to come together to win. But I heard from both people on the left and in the center that they wanted a little more meat put on those bones.
What kind of efforts has the party made to do that? I know there was the kind of Biden-Sanders supporters getting together to try to craft this this platform, this unity platform. What are we seeing at the convention, though, when it comes to efforts to lay out that kind of vision?
Well, we are seeing some moves in that direction. And there was, as you mentioned, this task force that Biden's people put together after he had won this commanding lead, where he brought in people from the Sanders campaign, from other parts of the left, to try to see if they could find some common ground. And as a result, Biden and certainly Kamala Harris along with him have moved left in a way, very few people would ever read the actual platform of the party, but it exists and you can look it up online. And what you'll see if you take a look at it is that it is well to the left of any Democratic platform since 1972. That said, it's not everything that the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's of the world would want it to be. And there are certainly any number of issues on which Biden is sticking to his moderate traditions. So they are trying to be a little bit of all things to all people, but there's been a definitive move somewhat leftward to embrace some of the ideas around racial justice, climate change reforms, and other reforms that, and especially a re-emphasis on science and medicine as a way of getting a handle on the coronavirus.
Is this that unusual for, you know, a party convention? We've seen Republicans in past years sometimes with social conservatives trying to make sure that their stuff ends up with commitments in the platform, and more maybe libertarian or economic conservatives having different approaches. Is this really that weird in the scope of American party politics?
No, you're absolutely right. This is par for the course. This happens at every convention. And what also happens after every convention is that nobody ever looks at that platform again. being a little bit exaggerating there. But in fact, the way politics works, the way government works, new issues will come along, new coalitions will be created. And so the platform is kind of a wish list. It's not really a menu. It's not really a directive for how a new administration would govern. And in that wish list are all the things from these two different factions. And what will happen is the elections will determine which of those items on the platform actually get moved on. And so the imperative to get Democrats elected, I think that's the Biden camp's argument all along. And that's the one that will eventually prevail, because if they don't win a Democratic majority in the Senate, they're not going to be able put any of these reforms into motion. If they don't retain their House majority, they won't be able to do this. So it's building the broader coalition to get elected and get a majority that really takes first order in the coming months and beyond.
Talking to Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You can join in with your reactions so far to the Democratic National Convention and to this next story, the latest doings at the U.S. Postal Service, especially in an election year where a lot of ballots are expected to come in by mail. We had this announcement yesterday from the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, saying, hey, we're backing off. We're stopping making these changes, not going back on other changes, though. I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on MSNBC responding to yesterday's announcement. Here's a listen.
Let me just say, nice try, not so nice try, on the part of the Postmaster General.
Yeah.
What he did was take three big steps forward and took one baby step back. And that just doesn't do it for us.
And DeJoy, the Postmaster General, is going to appear before committees in both chambers of Congress, I believe. What is your read on some of the latest back and forth over changes at the Postal Service?
Well, look, we have a bipartisan consensus here. This is very rare in Washington these days. Both Democrats and Republicans concluded that this issue was really hitting hard, that people across the country were enraged at the cutbacks and mail delivery and at the prospective cutbacks for a political purpose of dampening the number of people who could vote by mail. The Democrats, we see, immediately jumped on that. They're calling these hearings. They're bringing in the Postmaster General. If you're watching any of the convention, you're seeing lots of references to the Trump administration's attempt to tear down the Postal Service in the country. And the Republicans agreed that this is hitting hard because they immediately backed off. And the Postmaster General issued this striking statement, backing away from all of the delays and cutbacks that he'd put into motion. Now, will he really restore those cuts? We don't know that. That's what the hearings will try to elicit from him. But clearly, at least on a superficial PR level, this is a real retreat by the Trump administration. And as Speaker Pelosi points out, that doesn't mean that just because they've retreated rhetorically doesn't mean that they're going to bring back the level of service that would smooth the vote in November.
And we've seen Republican lawsuits challenging some changes in different states that would make it easier for people to vote by mail. Are we going to see this battle over not just the vote, but over how we cast our votes from now until Election Day, maybe beyond?
Well, we're going to see an initial battle, as you say, with these lawsuits and these various efforts by state legislators and governors, especially in Democratic states, to make it easier for people to drop off ballots at special drop-off boxes rather than using the mail system, those kinds of reforms. But they have to be done very, very soon because the rules of the election get locked down well before Election Day. So that's just a story over the next couple of weeks. Then there's the story that happens starting on election night. And up until then, there's a huge education process that has to go on, where Americans who expect results on election night are going to have to learn to be a little more patient. It's not entirely novel. We went through this in 2000 when the vote dragged on through the various court hearings and the checking of chads in Florida in the Gore versus Bush race that dragged on well into December. So we could see that kind of a long dragged out election return this time around, or maybe it'll go a lot more smoothly. The last few primaries have led some state officials to say, we've got this now, and we understand how to get these votes counted with relative speed, and it may not be quite that dragged out.
We invited listeners to call in about the Democratic Convention, the party, and its platform. Let's bring one on now at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Glendale. Mary, hi.
Hi. I have a question about whether they are going to discuss the fact that our military budget is so high if you include the past wars. So the government now does not include the VA or things from past wars in the budget. They put it somewhere else. And so if you do include all those things, it comes to 52% of the budget. And that's a huge amount of our budget. I don't think we need such a huge military. They're antiquated in many ways. They need reform.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Let's talk about that. Now, at the convention, we had former Secretary of State John Kerry, former Republican Secretary of State and retired General Colin Powell attacking President Trump on foreign policy and defense issues. But some Democrats saying this is kind of the old guard and more, addressing some of Mary's concerns, more pro-military, pro-war than, say, someone like Mary might like. What are we seeing in the platform and the messaging here?
Well, we're on the cusp of some sort of a party realignment in our country. We have a president who has led the Republicans into a withdrawal from American military presence in places like Germany and South Korea, who wants to kind of pull back his whole America First approach. That is not a traditionally Republican position. Similarly, on the Democratic side, we've had several Democratic administrations, the last two, Clinton and Obama, that were very strong supporters of military military spending, military presence around the world, a really muscular American presence. Now we have left-wing reformers in the Democratic Party who want to pull back, much as there were voices in the Democratic Party that wanted to shift in that direction back in the 1970s. So we're going to see this shifting going on in both parties in the coming years, but it's all in the context of the tremendous hit to the budget that's been caused by this economic collapse as a result of the coronavirus. So I don't think you're going to see any major moves in any direction regarding military spending until we get a better handle on what the economic situation will be over the next couple of years.
We're talking to Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher about some top stories in national politics, including the final Senate Intel report on Russia coming up, latest on the Postal Service and the Democratic National Convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on those issues. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, looking at some top stories in national politics. Let's bring on another caller now. John is with us in Oshkosh. John, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, Rob. I was just curious why the Democratic platform doesn't include the necessity to fill in a lot of high-level government positions that are currently vacant or otherwise occupied by people that have no experience in those positions that they've been put in by the Trump administration, nepotism, so to speak. I would think that would fly pretty well with a lot of the Democrats and a little bit left of center people.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Have we seen that line of attack, Mark, people attacking the president for his appointees, many changes, a lot of acting this and that in the cabinet and elsewhere?
The caller is absolutely right. I haven't heard a word about that, and I've watched every minute of the convention. It's kind of curious because it is a natural issue, and it's one that the Biden campaign is really working hard on. I know of several people here in Washington who are working full time now on vetting possible cabinet choices, agency head choices. So that work is well underway, and you would think that the Democrats would want to embrace that as and show their preparedness, their planning, a level of competence that perhaps is lacking on the in the Trump administration. I think we'll hear more of those kinds of attacks on the Trump competence and performance so far tonight, especially perhaps in the vice president's in Kamala Harris's address. That's the traditional vice presidential role at a convention. So we'll probably hear more of that, but it is an issue that they're hard at work on.
I want to switch gears now to what I think in normal times might be the top story today. The Senate Intelligence Committee released its fifth and final report after a years-long investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election and the way that meddling was investigated. What stood out to you? This is a big report. What stood out to you as some key findings?
It's 1,000 pages. I can't claim to have read every one of them. But as you dip into it, you see that this is everything that a lot of people who opposed the Trump administration had hoped the Mueller report would be. And so as bland and as cautious as the Mueller report was about drawing any conclusions, this is a remarkable document because this is a truly bipartisan document that the Senate committee led by Mark Warner of Virginia, the Republican Richard Burr, North Carolina, they have come together and put out a report that makes very clear that the Russians intervened in the 2016 election, that the Trump campaign not only knew about it, but was an active partner in it. It lays out in extraordinary detail the contacts between Trump's people and the Russian agents. The Trump campaign manager, Paul Manafort, had daily contact with an active Russian agent. This is the kind of detail that was not in the Mueller report. It's all laid out here. And the most remarkable thing about it is that this is both a Democratic and Republican document, one that they came together on. Again, a sign of bipartisanship that we have not seen in Washington in a long time. People might say, well, where was this before the impeachment? And they went about this in an extremely careful way. And it's a very thorough document. It could not have been produced that quickly. And so there's a lot that's been redacted from there. So it's not an easy read. But the detail in there, it takes us well beyond where we were during the impeachment process.
bipartisanship aside, key Republicans and Democrats have emphasized different parts of it. I want to give a listen to Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, talk about what he thought were key findings of the report. Here's a listen from a statement he released on Twitter.
First, we found absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Donald Trump or his campaign colluded with Russia to meddle in our elections. Second, the FBI made some very troubling mistakes, especially by relying on a Steele dossier against the advice of the CIA and without verifying this foreign document or the sources that were used to create it. And third, Russia's still meddling, and now so is China and Iran.
How are you seeing some of the partisan reaction and the partisan, I guess, spin on this playing out?
Well, Rubio is absolutely right. There is criticism of the FBI in this report. It's not enormous. It doesn't take us much beyond where we already what we already knew about. But obviously, the Republicans are going to try to use that in the remaining weeks of the campaign against the Democrats. But Rubio also pointed out that there is extraordinary evidence here that the Russians were and still are trying to meddle in the U.S. election process. That's now a bipartisan consensus. Of course, the president doesn't accept that. The president railing against this report even today. And so there is more of a divide here between some Republicans in Congress and their president than we've seen in recent years.
Talking to Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. I want to get to another piece you worked on for The Post, looking at mask wearing around the country. We've seen polls showing that most people favor masks. A majority, anywhere from two-thirds to three-quarters, favor mask mandates. A lot of attention to anti-mask protesters. You went out and looked at people who are getting more active in advocating for masks. What kind of things did you find?
I heard a real frustration. I mean, if you look at the polls, if you go out and talk to folks, there's a very large majority of Americans who are on board with the idea of masks, who are complying with both the recommendations and the mandates. And they're frustrated that this louder, small minority of anti-mask people are getting a lot of the attention because they make a lot more noise. They hold those demonstrations. So you're seeing those pro-mask people kind of stepping up and speaking out. They're not going to hold big demonstrations. They're not going to take weapons and go to state capitals because by their very nature, if they've accepted the idea of masks, they don't want to be around large crowds of people. But in their own ways, through letters to the editor, through grassroots campaigns, through efforts to get their local officials to issue mandates and have stricter rules and enforce those rules, you are seeing movements all across the country to get people to get on board with mask wearing, with social distancing. People, I think, are getting very frustrated with the length of shutdown that we've seen around the country and the continuing ramifications, the surges of cases, the number of deaths, and they are pushing back against the anti-mask crowd. But by virtue, by nature of the fact that they are mask wearers, those pushbacks are not quite as loud and boisterous as we've seen from the anti-crowd.
And something that struck me was that at least some of the people you talked to were people who were at risk for one reason or another, for whom COVID-19 wouldn't just be a nuisance, probably.
Absolutely. And they are, in many cases, the people who are most upset to see folks pushing back against mask wearing. A lot of people make the comparison to seatbelts, which were initially, it's hard to think about it now, but if you go back and look at what happened back when they were first mandated, there was a tremendous pushback, very similar in character to what we're seeing against masks. That kind of classic American sense of leave me alone, I get to make my own choices, this is about individual rights. It's a classic American confrontation we're seeing between that sense of the collective good versus individual rights. And obviously, there are great arguments on both sides of that. But as the Supreme Court has said over and over again, there are public health emergencies that trump individual rights. And so and courts have now said over and over, and more local governments are saying that this is one of those cases.
Last 30 seconds or so, so much news out there. What is on your radar for the next week?
Well, next week we'll be seeing, of course, the Republican convention and a very different kind of message. We've already been told that the couple from St. Louis that waved guns at Black Lives Matter protesters are going to be speaking at the Republican convention. So a very different kind of character to that convention. Whether they'll choose the same style as the Democrats have chosen of kind of embracing Zoom and kind of not trying to repeat what conventions normally look like, that's still to be seen. And I think we'll continue to see rather small audiences for these conventions. And I'm not sure what that says about interest in this campaign or enthusiasm for these candidates.
Mark, thanks again for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, co-author of the biography Trump Revealed. We talked to him about some of the top national political news stories this week, including a Senate report on Russian meddling in the 2016 election, movement on the U.S. Postal Service story, and the Democratic National Convention. We're going to spend some more time talking about that convention coming up in just a few minutes here on the show. Feeling happy can make you smile. That's no secret. But could it be that smiling can make you feel happy? There's been ongoing research over the years to find out. In some of the latest research published in the journal Experimental Psychology, Australian researchers tried to find out if working the face muscles that do the smiling could light up the happiness parts of the brain and make us feel more positive. It turns out that, at least according to this study, yeah, it does. Research subjects didn't just plaster fake smiles on their faces. They actually had to hold pens in their mouths, you know, crossways like. That apparently uses the same muscles that smiling does. They had people then evaluate facial expressions and other things. And when people had the pens in their mouths and had their smiling muscles engaged, they felt more positively about the things they saw. Researchers say that triggering the smile muscle stimulates the amygdala in the brain, which apparently can give us a more positive feeling about the world. Let's give it a try. I have a pen here. I usually don't because I fidget with pens when I have them. Here we go. I have a pen in my mouth now, and I kind of just feel silly, actually. I don't know if I feel any happier having the pen in my mouth. So, yeah, I'm not going to put that into practice. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.